Okay, so let's get over to the news. A couple of announcements. This Thursday, I'm going to be speaking with John, and I got this wrong. Session. Oh, if I messed it up, I'll put his name in the comments anyway. It's just, hey, John at NMOA. You know, I've been bumping shoulders with John for years, and like many people there, you just know their last name or their first name. That's all that's on the card. I was fighting for NMOA for years to fix the card as my eyesight dimmed. Anyway, it's going to be great. It's going to be Thursday afternoon. I sent out an email, I think on Friday, with the details. But the details are at NYCDM. Is that right? No. DMC, like Direct Marketing Club, DMCNY.org. DMC, and I'll put that in the comments too. I'll put a link to that. So off we go with Tom Fishburne. And here we go. Let's see over to here. Marketing myopia and brand choice. Okay. Excuse me, can I ask why you chose that brand? Was it our package design, our lofty brand purpose, our deep emotional advertising, our social media banter, our digital ads that track you, or are you a brand loyalist? And the shopper says, everything looked about the same and this one was half off. Yes, indeed. The way I shop entirely. In fact, when my wife had some health challenges way back and my kids were little, I bought the generic Campbell's soup, not the Campbell's, but the generic chicken noodle soup for one penny less. Like the regular, hello Ben, the regular Campbell's soup was like 35 cents and the generic was like 34 cents and it wasn't any good. I have to admit, there was like no chicken and no noodles and the broth tasted terrible. So my kids have teased me ever since about shopping poorly. But isn't there a lot of truth in that, you know, for all the work you do? So the question is, what motivates consumers to buy? Back in 2015, this is Ferris Jacob, wrote an article and coined the term first moment of truth. He said there's three steps. The first point of contact is the ad that tells you about the product. That's why advertising is so important in a free market where there's choice. Think about that if you decide you want to be a socialist, that you won't have 100 different cell phones to choose from. You'll be told which one is the best and you have to buy it, like it or not. The second is when they take an action towards the brand. So they could be visiting a store or searching the web. The third is when they find it, and then they still have to make that decision. Okay, so those are the moments of truth. Then all prior brand communication comes to bear, or a screeching halt maybe, comes to bear on a single moment, the 3 to 5 seconds when the consumer stands in front of the shelf and decides what to buy. Interesting and innovative packaging can make up for lower media weights, such as craft beer companies or Method Soap that focused on making their bottles something people would be proud to display in their homes. That pretty much never comes into account. I think more on the level of, will this make my skin fall off, or is it okay to get me clean? My style consultant occasionally says that I'm not like other people and I shouldn't laugh at everything I say. She says both of those. They're not necessarily connected. A few years, but I didn't laugh at that, you notice. A few years before I worked on the Method Soap brand, Ferris writes about, I was marketing intern at General Mills. The CMO at the time, Mark Addix, shared some marketing career advice that always stuck with me. He warned that too much time in the marketing offices would lead to breathing our own exhaust, which I think means like breathing your tailpipe gases. And in particular, he urged us to spend as much time as possible in the grocery store aisles, silently watching people as they shop the categories we work on. Right. The first thing we should do is take out an empty notebook. Mark went on to suggest that whenever we join a new brand team, or if you were like a new ad agency that had just started pitching the account, you should write down what you think you know about that brand, what associations you have in your head, what preconceived notions you have in your head, because those are probably closer to consumer perceptions than whatever you're going to be fed by all the data and all the analysis and all the focus groups and all of the other stuff. Okay, so this notebook is uncorrupted with institutional knowledge big companies have access to. All of this corporate research, shopper decision trees, category management decks, and the like can be valuable, but followed too closely, they can lead to marketing myopia. Okay? Consumers don't think about brands nearly as much as marketers of those brands think about brands. And I'm struck by this classic line from Byron Sharp in How Brands Grow. Rather than striving... I love this one. Rather than striving for meaningful perceived differentiation, marketers should seek meaningless distinctiveness. Branding lasts, differentiation doesn't. In other words, if you really have a new product, you have really something special, your competitors will copy it. Even if they don't copy it, they'll say they copied it. This happened to me a few times. But if you pick up something that maybe all the other brands do and you claim it, like David Ogilvy famously claimed that cars love Shell gas. And they had a slogan, cars love Shell. And then they had the Shell Answer Man. And the Shell Answer Man told you about the special things they do to Shell gas to make it clean and pure and good for your car. And, of course, the funny part was that all gas was done that way. All the refineries did the same steps, had the same detergents for your ink, for your, not your inkjet, your whatever it is in your car that squirts the gas in. And I know it's some kind of jet. And they all did it. But once Shell had staked it out, if you said, oh, well, we do that too, it sounds like you're just whining. So sometimes the meaningless can be more distinctive than the distinctives. And I promise to be loyal, forsaking all other brands unless you're out of stock, your competitor is on sale, or you just are not meeting my need states at the time. She's saying her pre-written vows to the can of cherry juice or something. Inside the mind of consumer, my husband, my kids, my friends, career, mom, dad, me, travel, sunsets, Fifi, home. I don't see our brand of pickle relish anywhere. It's inconceivable. This is a brand loyalist. And that is high level neuroscience for you today. Okay, so let's go over to this one from My Total Retail, Eric Rosenthal. And he says, are retailers ready for the return to in-person shopping? And I can tell you, it's a resounding no. Right? First of all, my wife went looking for Bed Bath & Beyond in Brookfield, and it's gone. And Marshall's is gone, I think, and there was a whole bunch of stores that were just gone, not open at all. Well, that's clearly not what she was expecting, because they used to be there. So that was no good. At its best, shopping is aspirational. Shopping is rarely aspirational for me. But anyway, I bought a package of bees on Friday, and I spent the weekend worrying about what to do next, and then got talked out of my strategy into a different one and got stung 6 times last night, but I think I'm off and running. So that's aspirational. I've always wanted to have some bees, and now I have some, but I hope they live. In the pandemic, we romanticized in-person shopping. Okay, and you can ask me how that goes. Ask me next spring. We'll know for sure. As consumers step out into the post-pandemic world, they're finding that in-person shopping isn't living up to their expectations. Every time my wife tries to go out shopping, she says, all the stores have the same ugly stuff. And by all the stores, she means like Target, Walmart, and Kohl's. I mean, that's like the rest of the stores got put out of business by our governor. And just it's crumpled heaps of clothing, bare shelves, dirty floors, and poorly trained staffs. I went shopping with her a couple of times into Bed Bath & Beyond and talked her into some cookie sheets, which worked superbly, and I bought some baking pans for my baking projects. And the cookie sheets were priced at about $40 for a cookie sheet. She said, that's ridiculous. I can't buy that. Well, I looked carefully at it, and the $40 ones were less involved, had less items in the wrapper than something that was selling for $20. And so I walked over to the little scanner thingy on the post, and it told me it was $20, and they were mixed up, and they were all mixed up. And so I got a manager happened to walk by, and I said, this is all mixed up. And she said, yeah, we can't get any good help these days. Would you like a job? I'm not kidding, really, truly. And my wife found that to be the case, you know, and that's a pretty good store, and it's pretty well stocked. It's nicely done, and they have a lot of interesting stuff. I really do like shopping in Bed Bath & Beyond because I like kitchen utensils and things. I like fine knives and cookware. So anyway, but it was all mixed up, and that isn't going to get fixed by what this guy proposes, which is we need more technology. Yeah, but if nobody looks at the shelves, it isn't going to matter. We need to have digitized tech checklists. Okay, and I love it. You know, digital is working so well in other areas. Let's make it, let's apply it to teaching our staff to care. Many retail workers say they feel neglected and unfulfilled. That's kind of, I think, what you're supposed to feel like. You're supposed to aspire to something like, you know, nuclear physicist or marketing maven or something. But anyway, 7 out of 10 say better digital tools would help them feel more engaged and valued. Where did we get, according to a recent survey? I wonder who did that one. Probably this company. Anyway, so, you know, I just want to say they're not ready for prime time. When it comes to price perception matters, and this is something I really wanted. I want to take a little bit of time on, because it's not what you charge; it's what people think you charge. When I started working for Cabela's, I had the perception that they were very expensive. They had very nice catalogs, coated stock, and even some perfect bound catalogs. And it said "World's Foremost Outfitters." I don't know what that is, but it sounded expensive to me. So I placed an order, and it was expensive, but, you know, because I grew up fishing, so I can go to Walmart and get it used to be 67-cent poppers. It's a fly rod, fly fishing fly. And most people would never buy those. Most serious fly fishermen would never, ever, ever try those. But you catch fish on them. They work pretty well if you know where to put the fly and how to do it. So I was, you know, anyway, I was buying it because I had to find out about Cabela's, which is like spending time in the aisles of the store if you're in e-commerce. Place some test orders. See how hard it is. So I placed that. So I'm talking through through the order, whatever it was I bought, and the lady on the phone said, would you like to hear our specials? And I said, okay. And she said, we have 3 crankbaits for $9. And I said, whoa, that's a pretty good deal, because I knew crankbaits were about $5 a piece. And I can tell you that it changed my entire perception of Cabela's. Just that one little suggestion. I knew it was a good deal because I knew what I was doing. And it was a pleasure working with Cabela's. But I would say they were aiming at the top, and you know, they did really well, especially while Dick was there. But sometimes your perception can get in the way of the reality. And back when I was managing an imprinted merchandise catalog, we did a paper test, and we did a lot of other tests. We started as very sort of high-end look. We let the creative department basically run wild, very, very light copy, lots of white space, and it didn't do very well. We did this test, which was which I've mentioned a few times, which was your imprint here, and One of the artists claimed I had to fire the creative director, and one of the artists claimed I was going to schlock up the catalog, which it kind of did, I admit. But we had a little more fun after that, and sales went up like crazy. But along the way, we did a 600,000 piece paper test. And I had learned, I had done creative for General Binding on their catalog, and they had done a flyer because they were so excited about direct mail. They were going to sell their the laminators to schools. And they sent out 150,000 pieces, and they got like three leads. They didn't even get any orders, and three calls. And they said, could you come up with some suggestions? I had not been involved. I didn't know who'd done it. But I noticed that they laminated this card. They said it was they had the pictures of the pharaohs and King Tut artifacts, and said, you know, make your students' junk last forever or something like that. And but they showed the big equipment that a printer would use for plastic laminating, like restaurant menus or something, and along with this other item. So I called up and I asked him some questions, and I said, why'd you put those other machines on there? Well, teachers know about us so much, we didn't need to focus on that one machine that we cared about that the teachers would care about. I said, okay, that's a mistake. And you laminated it, and then you put sale on the front. Nobody would mail this if they really were price conscious. This is a high-end mailing piece, even though it's a postcard. And they did a lot of other things. But basically, the piece wasn't credible because, you know, it could have been done on a cardstock, on a heavier weight paper, but it looked expensive. And so then we changed it all, and it did really well. But and I got a letter about how it was a personal vendetta with the artist. He wrote me, and I didn't even know who he was. But anyway, so I said, you know, maybe we should test the paper on our expensive looking catalog. And so we put it on groundwood. We were doing rotogravure. And so we could throw a lot of ink over, and we were hoping that the cheap paper would save us money. That was really, there had been a postage increase. That was really the main motivation. If it did as well but saved us money, we were in good shape. Well, what happened was sales were 20% higher on the groundwood than they had been on the regular, you know, regular offset stock. And you know, looking back on it, we sort of hypothesized that the thing that is in consumers' minds is FSIs. You know, in the Sunday paper or in your mailbox, you'll see flyers, sale flyers from a whole bunch of different companies and stuff, all stuff stuck together. And most of that is national advertisers doing long runs, and so it has that groundwood and high ink coverage like Roto. And it has a sort of smell to it, you know, and all of that sort of, and it's sale flyers. And so all of it kind of screams low price. And we think that our perception was of high price, even though our prices were actually at or below industry standards. But because we bundled a lot of stuff into it, it looked higher price. And so, and we worked on that too. So oftentimes there's ways to simply change the perception. Cub Foods used to go against competitors. They would take those sale flyers of their competitors and they would mount them on the walls as you came into the store, and they would put a big X over the competitor's low price, and then they'd write in big red letters their price right next to it and show you that it was a great deal. Now, what we did when we were working with Dominic's, this wasn't my idea, this was Bob Meyer, and he's a genius. But Bob said, instead of doing that, because we want to be perceived as competitive with Cub, we'll take the stuff that most people buy, the milk, the eggs, and that stuff, the stuff that's easy to compare, and we'll mark it equal to Cub, and then we'll go, and then we'll have other stuff that's just maybe, you know, a little more, and then we'll have the condiments, you know, the A1 sauce and the Jardiniere peppers that Cub doesn't even carry, and we'll mark those up maybe 10% above market to even everything out. And it worked brilliantly. It changed the perception of price, And it gave Dominick's Finer Foods the idea or the positioning that, hey, we're not a bad deal. Mostly we're not. You know, you might pay a little more for something, but, you know, do you really need that stuff anyway? And the stuff you really need, we're right on there. We're spot on. And the Chicago market was the only place Cub gave up at the time. I don't know if they're back there now, but they gave up at the time because it was so effective. And we also changed the ads. Instead of sale flyers, we ran aspirational ads. A big strawberry, full-page vegetables, piece of broccoli and stuff. And talked about how careful Dominick's was with their vegetables and how you know you're getting the best, very, very best quality. Worked like crazy. Changed both the perception, elevated the aspirational, and carefully was competitive in the price area. There's a lot you can do. Have a great day. Like and share. Your friends will know you're smart. Bye-bye.